Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, back in the hot seat after my week away, but I'm joined by the, I would say my two colleagues, but I want to say the two usurpers, Ian Wenick and Andrew Forsh, who very brilliantly handled the pod last week. Ian and Andrew, great to see you again, and yeah, great job last week. Sort of feel a little insecure about this role now, but how are you both doing?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my days as the lead host, it's probably for the best that they're few and far between. You know, I can't set them up the way that you do. I can't.
That's very kind of you. This is flattery, and it will get you pretty much everywhere. Andrew, I was sad to miss your return to the pod and to the office last week, having been away for a month or so on paternity leave.
Correct. Yeah,
I'm going to do a bit of an Ian here and make a sort of visual reference that in an audio format will completely fall flat. But listener, what you're missing is the growth that Andrew's gone through in this period of time. I don't mean personal. I don't mean, you know, how he's developed having had a child. I mean the fact he's got a full on Robinson Crusoe style beard that I assume you stopped shaving the minute you went on paternity leave and haven't picked up a razor since. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, I think I had a little baby beard going slightly before we went to the hospital, and then as soon as the baby was born, all attempts at regular grooming just have gone out the window. So we're still here. I think with conference season coming up, I'm going to have to try to tame this into some kind of manageable shape, but yeah, I'm letting it go as far as we can.
No, it's excellent. It's giving very strong, yeah, so Tom Hanks Castaway vibes.
Well, I'm still merging back into civilization, learning how to live again. This is the,
you're kind of still on the island in some respects. I think you are for the first 6 months, although yeah, very quickly, because we do probably need to get on with talking about, you know, the wealth management industry. I thought your update last week on where you are in terms of fatherhood and everything was very nice, very touching. I'm worried for you a little bit that it's gone too well and things like sleep regression are going to kick in and hit you hard. But I'm very happy for you and how it's gone.
Thank you. Yeah, wary of all of that. As long as I can say it's going kind of better than maybe I expected, I'll be soaking that in. So,
well, absolutely. Well, look, guys, let's crack on, because I'm sure as much our listeners are very fascinated in our, you know, facial hair and families, they probably tuned in to hear us talk about wealth management. And if they have, they're in luck, because we've got some great stories to talk about this week. Couple of what I would describe as almost sort of classic City Wire RIA stories. So some big old sort of M&A, but which also speaks to the sort of the broader trends going on in this space at the moment and how things have evolved. So, Ian, not a huge surprise here. Going to kick off with you, and I would say our big scoop, probably the industry's big scoop this week, about MAI Capital buying Evoke Advisors. Two huge firms combined going to put together an RIA with north of $60 billion. So one of the biggest kind of, well, it's not quite a merger, is it? Because it is really MAI buying Evoke, but one of the biggest sort of combinations of pure play RIAs that we've seen in a long time. And a story that you've been on for a while.
I mean, I find this fascinating because this is one of the biggest mergers or combinations of equals that we've seen since we've started writing about this business in 2018. I mean, the only other direct comps that I can think of would be the combination of Edelman Financial Services and Financial Engines, but that was financed by a private equity investor. And then last year, we broke the story on Hall Capital merging with Pathstone. That's a pretty similar size and scale transaction. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of threads to pull here. I think the story of the Evoke team and how they got to where they are is fascinating too. I mean, you're talking about one of the first kind of big breakaways. They've been through multiple channels, and I'm kind of fascinated to see how they work and fit in as part of a larger RIA as opposed to operating on their own. We get into that too.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. Maybe just before we do, could we step back and just break down the deal a little bit? Because obviously, we sort of talked about it as a merger, but it is fundamentally an acquisition, isn't it? Can you go into a little bit of detail, or as much as we have? Because as we know with many of these things, you know, exact terms and numbers aren't necessarily disclosed. But yeah, how does that break down?
Well, just because they're not disclosed doesn't mean that I can't get them.
Okay. Well, what have you got?
So what I do have is that, so we don't have the exact headline purchase price of this transaction, but this was structured in a way that MAI is using its consideration to buy Evoke. It's a 50-50 split between cash and stock. And so for context, so MAI, the way that their executive chairman, Rick Bohncore, described it to me is they're 52% owned by employees of MAI and Galloway Holdings, which is an insurance holding company. And then the remainder of MAI's equity was owned by the private equity sponsors of Galloway, which includes Carlyle Group, Oak Hill Capital, and then Harvest Partners is the controlling private equity investor in Galloway. And what Rick told me was that the proportion of MAI's equity that will be owned by employees will increase as a result of the deal, but we don't know the exact number.
Okay, because those Evoke employees
it's dilutive.
Direct, so getting stock in the combined company. Got it. Okay, and then you touched on this a little bit with Evoke, so maybe we could start with them. But what's, you know, for people who are less familiar with these two firms, what's their background?
Yeah, so I mean, the history of Evoke dates all the way back to 2008. When a major team of advisors broke away from Merrill Lynch to start an independent RIA called Luminous Capital. Now, Luminous was one of the biggest breakaways ever. That was right in the middle of the financial crisis. So those four advisors, that includes the majority owner of Evoke's primary holding company, David Howe, Mark Sear, and Alan Zaffrin and Robert Skinner. So that quartet broke out of Merrill in 2008. Then they sold Luminous to First Republic, no longer with us.
RIP, yep.
For $125 million in 2012. Now, that number sounds like pocket change compared to the REA deals that we see today.
I'd take it, probably, but yeah.
But back then, I mean, that was just like, and I hate using business reporting cliche, that was an eye-watering amount of money back then to pay $125 million for an REA. And so they stayed at First Republic for about 7 years. And then in 2019, that quartet, they broke up and they formed two different independent RIAs. So David Howe, Mark Sear, they founded Evoke out in LA. And then Alan Zaffrin and Robert Skinner, they started IEQ Capital, which today is minority backed by Stone Point Capital, frequently mentioned on this pod. They've operated as two separate independent RIAs. They've gone their separate ways. And we broke in January that Evoke was looking to raise money. At the time, they were prioritizing a minority investor, which preview of what we'll talk on the pod later. But yeah, I found it shocking that this team chose to pivot to merge into part of large organizations as opposed to staying independent.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, they are, to everything you've just said, a kind of, in some way, shape, or form, this firm or the people at the top of it have kind of charted that evolution of the RIA industry from sort of initial breakaway, gone back kind of in-house to a sort of wire or big private bank, broken away again. And given that it's, let's call it its sister company, but the company the other two started, IEQ, you know, did then obviously have a track record of raising assets very quickly and getting a private equity backer, which is kind of the next step in that sort of RIA evolution. It's almost a surprise that given Evoke's success, its size, its track record and what it's done before, that it hadn't had an outside backer before now, frankly. As we've discussed in this podcast before, there aren't that many firms of that size and with that kind of that caliber, I suppose, that are still sort of sitting on the shelf, as it were. And yeah, maybe a surprise that they've gone this route, which I suppose maybe takes us to a nice place where we could talk about MAI and what they are and maybe why Evoke went the way it did.
Yeah, I mean, so MAI, just to give some context, I mean, MAI, the origins date back to the 70s. It was originally formed by Mark McCormack, who was one of the country's first sports agents. He founded IMG, major, major sports agency, if you're a sports fan, as I hope many of our listeners are. And yeah, I mean, this company, so they've transitioned. They obviously had a large athlete practice. They've been one of the biggest and most prolific acquirers in the RIA industry over the last couple of years. So they've been backed by Wealth Partners Capital Group, a serial REA minority investor since 2017. And that basically turned on the deal machine. I mean, MAI did 12 acquisitions in 2024 alone. I'm sure they've done, I don't have the exact number offhand, I'm sure they've done north of like 40-something acquisitions since 2017. And then the Galway deal happened in 2021. So you have this massive firm that has rolled up a lot of smaller practices. They have this clear athlete vertical. They have a trust services company. They even started this new, have a new unit where they will help introduce clients who might be dealing with rare diseases to specialist doctors. So similar to like what Pastor, we mentioned earlier, they're trying to do a little bit of everything for a lot of these mass affluent to wealthy clients. And you know, Evoke has this ultra high net worth client base. It's worth noting that Evoke, a large chunk of their assets are managed on a non-discretionary basis too. They're working on a consultative basis with a lot of these ultra high net worth 50 million plus families. But as David Howe told me before we broke the story, yeah, they wanted to get to a place where they could have access to additional services. And so it made sense for them to combine with a firm like MAI that has a little bit of everything, kind of a jack of all trades firm.
Got it. Really interesting. Well, look, I think we've covered a lot there. I suppose the last thing to say is what happens now going forwards? Does the Evoke brand disappear? What happens to the people at the top of that business?
Yeah, so the Evoke brand is going to remain as a sub-brand for MAI's ultra high net worth offering. And then three of Evoke's top leaders, including David Howe, they will become managing partners at MAI.
Got it. Fantastic. Well, look, we've got another deal to talk about. I suppose before, was there anything else we haven't covered there that we should have done?
No, I mean, I think we covered that pretty comprehensively. I mean, we spent so much time talking about it, so it feels almost anticlimactic having actually published the story.
Yeah, I mean, we should say, let's do a little bit of behind the story. This was something that, you know, Ian certainly got wind of about a couple of months ago. So we had a bit of an inside track on this. Obviously, more detail came out, and there's a point at which we could run it. So yeah, for Ian, this has been kicking around in his head for some time. So maybe there's like a therapy session. You can sort of get it all out, Ian. Good. Okay, well, let's pivot now to our other deal. And Andrew, this is what you're here for, I suppose, which is another exclusive from CityWire, which is about Merchant Investment Management taking a minority stake in a firm called, I'll try and get this right because it's been a while since I've done Latin. Obviously, I did Latin. I'm British. I went to school. Validus Capital, which is a $2.5 billion firm in California. I suppose let's dive into the story and then we can follow up with some questions here as well. But yeah, maybe give us a skinny to kick this off.
Yeah, so Validus, they're in El Segundo, kind of South LA by the airport. It's a ultra high net worth focused RIA, kind of a multifamily office model founded by a guy called John Crambier. Listeners may know him as the founder and a longtime executive of Camden Capital. That firm actually was kind of a big deal too. So John and his team, I believe they were at Merrill Lynch. They broke away in the early 2000s, want to say 2003, maybe 2004, and founded this kind of early RIA. And what's interesting about Camden was they, and John's kind of vision for it was they were early in the sort of private investment stuff. So they had all of these kind of private equity relationships, firms like Blue Owl, they had private credit, they had, you know, hedge fund access. And so that was kind of a big deal and something different that John did at Camden. And over time, you know, they grew the firm. And my sense is, you know, and from talking to John about it, like there was sort of a irreconcilable rift between him and some of the company's other managers. John wanted to go deeper in the kind of family office model, ultra high net worth focused services, that kind of bespoke wealth management, really high touch. And some of the other managers of the company wanted to lean more into heavy growth, kind of more traditional mass affluent service. You know, the way John put it is you couldn't get down the river both ways. And so he left in 2022 and formed his new company, Validus, basically to realize that vision. And so he's been doing that for a couple of years now. When he left, he took a team of staffers from Camden. He had about $1 billion, maybe a little bit more in client assets. So not starting from zero, but he's been growing that firm for about 3 years. And yeah, the time was right for them to take on some outside capital here. And so that's what they've done. And Merchant is... you know, if you're a reader of CityWire, you know they typically make minority investments in RIAs. They have kind of gone outside of that purview a little bit lately. They've done some majority deals. They've invested in some non-wealth management, I guess what you would call wealth management service providers, so service providers to RIAs. And this is maybe sort of a return to form for them in terms of, you know, this is sort of a wheelhouse type of deal.
Yeah, I was going to say they've and this. I'd like to come back to Validus and John in a moment to talk about kind of what that firm's journey speaks to more broadly, but maybe just for a moment on Merchant. Yeah, it feels like this year some of their more recent deals have been those sort of RIA adjacent businesses. So sort of, Ian, you could jump in and help me with the actual, you can color in the lines for me here, but sort of business valuation, sort of investment banky type things that maybe at first didn't make sense to us when we were reporting on them. But as I understand it, the idea is these services can then be offered to RIA's clients as much as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that they've done basically since inception. I mean, they have their own compliance consultancy that they own. But yes, they invested in WR Valuation, which is a valuation consultancy. They staked a South Dakota-based trust services provider, Sterling Trustees. So, I mean, I've always viewed Merchant as a firm that's simultaneously trying to create its own network of affiliated RIAs, and then this entire separate kind of cloud of RIA-adjacent businesses that can provide services to them. So you can have your own kind of internal ecosystem that these RIAs can function in.
Yeah, really interesting. Okay, and then Andrew, just for a moment, back to Validus. I'm saying that.
You got it. Yep.
Roughly, correctly. I suppose an interesting thing here is, and this slightly ties together the two stories we've spoken about, both this current Merchant one and Ian's scoop on MAI, which is like, just the speed at which you can do that. You know, obviously this is John's obviously a guy who's been around for a long time. He's broken away in the sort of classic way from the wires back in the day, but that you can kind of spin out a firm and 3 years later sell a minority stake speaks to maybe where the RIA industry is as a whole and how much, you know, money there is investing in practices.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, I would say this probably isn't your average like mom and pop RIA. I mean, they're growing quickly. They're at something like $2.5 billion in assets. Some amount of that is not discretionary, but you know, to roughly double in 3 years after starting up and kind of bootstrapping it, you know, that it's not easy to do. Not a lot of folks are doing that. So I think there's probably maybe a little bit more kind of interest and meat on the bones of this firm for investors than maybe some other, you know, shops around the country. But plus, you know, I think there's an interest, and we've seen this broadly in the M&A marketplace. There's a real interest in the ultra high net worth focused firms. This is a lot of where kind of the ball is going. And there's just a ton of demand for this. I mean, these are firms that are bringing all kinds of different ancillary tertiary services in-house. And there's a lot of demand for that. So that makes them particularly attractive acquisition targets, I think.
And I think it also speaks to, and Ian, we touched on this, I can't remember, this summer, certainly, maybe three episodes ago, possibly four, on the rise of the minority investor. Now, obviously, Merchant's been around and been doing this for a while, as discussed, but just that is an option now for so many RIAs that perhaps it wasn't before. You know, it used to be perhaps you had to sell a majority or join a strategic or do, you know, join a roll up effectively. But now there is this avenue. There's so many people offering this avenue of selling a smaller stake and maintaining a greater degree of independence, certainly.
I mean, I think
Just quickly, I'll chime in and just say, I mean, John had a quote in the story saying basically exactly that. I mean, he says, you know, 10 years ago, this sort of deal wasn't really an option. You kind of either had to go it alone or give up control. Neither of which they think he went it alone for a long time. But I think neither of those options felt right for him. And Ian, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's all good. I mean, I think it just speaks to how crowded the space has become that we had an entire episode talking about the rise of the minority investor. And we didn't mention Merchant once on that episode, which is crazy to me because they were one of the early movers.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's just so many options, effectively, so many people offering it. Excellent. Well, look, really interesting. I think both stories, as mentioned, sort of speak to obviously this big mega trend of how much money's just awash in this space, but also, yeah, that neither of those deals perhaps happened 10 years ago. Andrew, to the point you just made, that John made in the piece, that, you know, this just wasn't an option. And then Ian, obviously your story, just the fact that there's two RIAs of that size probably isn't a thing 10 years ago. And if there are, they're probably not looking to merge. There's not that sort of strategic imperative for them to do so.
Exactly. No, I mean, it just shows just how much this industry, has matured in just the last 5 to 7 years. I mean, the stuff that happens now that we just kind of take with like a blink of an eye is crazy to me. Sometimes I just have to take a step back and realize, look at just how far this industry has come. It's crazy.
Yeah, fantastic. And obviously, you know, great for us because there's loads to write about, and great. If you're interested in this stuff, you know, there's only really one place to get all of it. And it does happen to be Citywire RIA Citywire.com/RIA. That's our very snappy URL. Excellent. Okay, well, look, let's round things off by talking about the biggest deal of the year. Again, broken by us. I probably should stop saying that because it just feels a little braggy after a while, doesn't it? But let's go back to LPL Commonwealth, which must, at the end of the year, end up being the thing we've probably talked about most on this podcast. No massive update here, but we have got some numbers around how many people have joined, because that sort of was the big story, really. After the deal was done, it was, well, are these Commonwealth advisors going to go to LPL or not? LPL, Ian, has been saying it's targeting 90%, and we have some numbers around that now.
Yeah, so first I would say, in terms of time spent, LPL Commonwealth is probably number one. I do feel like, in terms of number of mentions on a raw number, I feel like baseball is probably the number one overall topic, because it's probably been mentioned at least once an episode at the end for the last like 3 or 4 months. But I'll set that aside. So we reported this week by our esteemed reporter Alec Rich, was RA prospecting firm Advisor Pro did some data crunching, and they found that Commonwealth has lost just over 230 advisors since LPL officially revealed the $2.7 billion transaction to acquire Commonwealth on March 31st.
Which sounds like a lot, but maybe isn't, or?
Yeah, from a raw number, that does sound like a lot, but as Hesam Parhiskar, who's Advisor Pro's co-founder, told us, that's really in line with LPL's goal of retaining 90% plus of these advisors. So yes, on a raw number, sure, that looks like a scary figure, but if you look at the data so far, I mean, it kind of tracks with what LPL has been wanting to do. Now, I will add one caveat, which is that, and this is a sense that I've gotten from talking to recruiters, from advisors around the industry, is that they don't view necessarily the closing date as the pencils down time for this proverbial exam. The closing date that they really view, like the real deadline, is when the assets and the technology convert over to the LPL platform in the middle of next year.
Okay, that's so the closing date was this year, and then the sort of assets onto the platform is next year.
Yes, the deal closed several weeks ago, but D-Day is middle of next year.
Okay, so that's the real. Yes. That's the real test. That's the real quiz. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think we got to just check in this time next year, or maybe around June of next year, and that will really tell the tale.
This is an unfair question because I don't know the answer to it, so I don't know that you necessarily would. But also, we don't know, when you say numbers of advisors, obviously different advisors oversee different volumes of assets. So not every advisor is sort of equal in that regard. So we also, do we have any numbers on that yet around sort of what assets those advisors have taken with them?
No, we don't have that yet, but that'd be very curious too. I mean, if we could find a way to scrape all the release data from people who move out of Commonwealth. But the thing is that even if you say like their announced book size, they're not bringing over 100% of those assets. So that's a number that might be a little bit of a black box for us, but it won't be for lack of trying.
Okay. Well, again, something to keep an eye on. Fantastic. Okay. Well, look, I think that's enough on that story for the time being. Before we go though, Ian, let's talk baseball for a minute. The Mets, we were at the Mets last night. By the time this goes out, will they have played again?
No. Yes. They're playing the Marlins on Thursday night, and I'll be in attendance for that game as well.
Okay, but something of a renaissance for your... Where do the Mets sit with you? You're a Padres fan. You have your family is are sort of Yankees
They
fans.
Are. Big. My dad is a Yankees diehard. He has his tickets.
But I feel like you also watch the Mets a lot. Where do they fit in your sort of baseball matrix of affection?
I'd say fairly neutral. I occasionally view the Mets as a source of comedy, depending on what's going on with them. You know, the thing is that, you know, if I'm angering any Mets fans, I mean, look, the Mets have absolutely nothing that they can hold over the Padres right now, considering the sweep that occurred at Petco Park and the defenestration of the 2022 Mets that we put on them with me in attendance in October of 22. That was a fantastic series, one of the best baseball games I've ever attended in my entire life. So, yeah, they can't talk anything to us.
Okay, good. So I was hoping to say something nice about them, but we've gone the other way.
They're fun. They're a fun team to watch.
The back. Excellent. Okay, Andrew, any thoughts on baseball?
I'm going to the Nationals game tomorrow, Friday night. So they're playing the Rays. I went to college in Tampa, so nice to see the Rays in town.
I watched the Rays last week. I was down in Florida. I watched them. Yeah.
Sneaky contender, the National Stadium. One of the top stadiums in the league, I think. It's not touching PNC. It's not touching San Francisco, but it's a great one.
Excellent. I've only been there once, and I got hit by a ball.
I remember that.
Yeah. Tried to catch it, didn't.
A 300-mile-an-hour line drive.
Yeah.
At least 300. Maybe 600. It was so fast. No one could have caught it. Yeah. It was
Marcus Stroman's fault. He was pitching that day.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. Well, look, on that note, I think we'll leave it there, but lovely to see you both. And listener, thank you very much as ever for tuning in. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.